Hello, and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most familiar work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we are back to talk about some more one after another chapters from one new perspective and one perspective we've already seen in this arc, which I thought would have invalidated the rules that we assumed this arc was going by, but maybe not.
It was funny because that chapter 10.D at the end of last week sort of ended with that moment with Lucy. So I was like, I guess it could be a Lucy perspective, but I didn't quite expect it. I guess I'm just riding this high from all these great interludes. I was hoping we get another wacky interlude.
Anyway, we get one interlude and one main character perspective chapter. But we'll get to that in a second. Let's start with the interlude. We're in Toad Swallow's head. And I think this is the interlude we've all been excited for over the course of the entire story, so I'm glad we finally got into it. Definitely pays off pretty well.
Yeah. Well, and this is the 100th chapter, too, so it's like a special 100th chapter celebration present from Wildbow. The point of view we've all been waiting for.
Yeah.
I think this chapter also hits a million words, which is also exciting.
Couldn't have happened with a better perspective character. So yes, we're in Toad Swallow's head and we watch his birth. He is yanked from the mud, born to participate in baby goblin cockfights. Despite the odds being stacked against him, he emerges victorious.
Yep, and he gets his name because he wins this fight by tricking the other guy into eating shit. So, I know, because we weren't in this chapter, his actual name is Turd Swallow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we see how he got that name. Yeah, it's good.
Well, ironically, he didn't earn it. Like, he didn't eat shit. The other guy did.
Well, yeah, true. So maybe he should never have been called Turd Swallow.
I don't know. I think that suits him perfectly, the being named after the time he tricked a guy into eating so much shit he was able to beat him.
Yeah, especially because that was his big emergence into the world. It tracks.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this whole, like, born to fight thing that happens to all these goblins just feels so on point for all the stuff we've been seeing with, like, Pekka Snot and just goblins in general with, like, how it feels like they're this real big commentary on, like, self-perpetuating toxic cultures. Like, there's a baby here who doesn't want to fight and so just promptly gets killed. And you can see, like that... It's sort of a statement on how, like, there's this sort of Darwinism to how violence can be perpetuated in, like, goblin culture.
Yeah, I like that. The comparison of it to this Darwinian idea makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's why goblins are the most violent, because they survive if they are the most violent. So, of course, they would be.
Yeah, and it's why, like, I've been so excitedly following all this stuff with Pekka Snot, because it seems like Verona is helping him escape it to some extent, like embracing his more artistic sides. And we're seeing in this interlude, like, Toad Swallow and a few of the others have got out being more than just shitty violence, but they're the exceptions more than the rule is kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I like that thought. I like the thought that Verona... is breaking this cycle with Pekka Snot. I think we can also see that Snowdrop and Cherry Pop's relationship, or even just Snowdrop's ties to the goblins in general, as well as, you know, Toad Swallow as a character, are all kind of similarly breaking that cycle. And I think that's very interesting and obviously ties into things that are happening on the, in the story.
Yep. We'll definitely get to talk a lot more about all those points you just brought up for sure. Yeah, but I think the other thing worth mentioning here is just this cool imagery. Like, so the line in the first paragraph sort of comes up is, this waste is pulled so deep that it transcends time and nature. Here, things do not rot, but recycle through, collect, bubble up, and sink down. And I just love this as a sort of, I guess, another metaphor for how this world works, because that's sort of what can happen with ideas, right? Like, it's similar to what it seems to happen with things that get lost. It makes me wonder why things down here don't necessarily get lost. Maybe they do if they sink far enough.
I just kind of love how, you know, everything in this world is spirits, right? It's spirits all the way down. And we kind of are seeing more examples of how I'm almost picturing it as like a ring. And at the very outer edges of this ring, spirits are the least formed and are just like pure concepts. And then as they come into the world, they get pulled into the center of this ring. They are more and more tangible. And, yeah, you know, giving birth to a goblin is literally reaching for a gross idea and pulling it out of that intangibility and into the, you know, the tangible world. I just think that's brilliant. I love it. It actually, because, you know, I'm interested if we've heard origin stories for other types of other, especially given what Toad talks about towards the end of this chapter, fairy. Do we have any info on that? I don't think we do.
I think we got some stuff. I can't remember if it was Guillemet or Marisica who said it, but there was talk of an idea that fairy were the children that were getting kidnapped and turned into glamour drowned.
Mm.
I think the only thing I can correctly remember them saying is that they don't remember. They're not fully sure.
Yeah.
But
very interesting.
I do think they went to that fairy market in Arc 8, and wasn't there one of the shopkeepers talking? Or was it in Shelley's thing? There was one point a fairy talked about having a grandchild, didn't they?
Yes, that was when they were in the fairy markets on the field trip. Yeah.
So, I mean, I suppose Toad Swallow and Bubblegum later on are going to talk a bit about having kids. So, maybe there's just multiple ways for, like, things like goblins and fairy to spawn?
Yeah. I mean, well, the way that they talk about having kids is obviously very much sexual reproduction, but maybe goblins consider birthing other goblins like that a kind of parentage. That doesn't really track, I guess.
Walking out to the rotten cabbage patch and pulling one out together.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that doesn't really track with how Toadie gets born, does it?
I don't know. I could see there being multiple ways of these things being created. True. It's more fun that way.
Yes. So, we jump back to the present, and the Kennet others are continuing to track the Witch Hunter. Toadie is kind of watching from on top of buildings. They're staying as safe as possible, despite obviously being worn down over time.
Yeah. And he's got this gum that he brings up here, which is more than just gum. I guess this is just a fun bit of foreshadowing for us learning about his paramour later on in the chapter.
Mm. Okay, great. No comment. So I think the meat of this chapter is Toad Swallow kind of observing, the meat of this part is Toad Swallow observing Guillemet setting these people up to distract the Witch Hunter. And I think that's great. I feel like this is the first time we've seen what it looks like for Faye to be doing this overt manipulation. And we can only really see it here because this is the most blunt that we've ever seen Guillemet be. But it's delightful to see Guillemet doing things like messing with people. You know, he shows two pictures to somebody. I don't think it's stated, but I think it's implied that one of the pictures looks like Raph. And
and
the guy's like, oh, yeah, exactly. He has psychopathic tendencies, basically, which I think is just a very blunt way, but a great way to just get somebody to pay a bit more attention to Raph to fuck with his head in a fun way.
Yeah, and I think the actual complexity, because there's a moment where Toad Swallow is like, oh, you're just doing this, and Guillemet has this bit where he's like, oh, actually, I'm doing like so much, and you couldn't even comprehend it, and this is so crude. One thing I really like of this chapter is how fake all the fairy actually feel.
Yeah.
Like, even Guillemet's a bit like, oh, you just don't understand.
Yeah.
We see later, like, we understand that he's sending people at the Witch Hunter, and then we learn, like, later on, also Marisica is sending people at the Witch Hunter doing different things, so there is that extra layer of, like, the way Marisica and Guillemet are playing off of each other.
Or against each other, right? But, like, I wanted to make that distinction because the fact that it's not them doing extra levels of things, it's them doing one thing but also being shitty to each other as their second level. Like, it's just so pointless, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's one of our first super concrete examples of, like, this top-tier level puppeteering that Fairy can do, and we're just seeing them use it to kind of bring each other to very near a draw.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is why they're not achieving much.
Yeah, although I guess it's worth touching on this because, you know, Toad calls out that Raph is part of their interplay, their sex games or whatever you want to call it. but, it, you know, given that Lucy ruminates on the fact that Raph being here at all is somebody has set that up, I wonder if this is hinting at that being either Marcy or Guillemet. And I have more thoughts on this once we get to that part of the next chapter, the end of the next chapter. But
okay,
it's just interesting to bring it up here because, you know, it's obviously becoming a recurring beat if it's happening here and also a few times in the next chapter.
Well, this straight up establishes a pattern of them manipulating him. So
exactly, yeah. Exactly right.
I also want to call out, I love like the exchange Toadstool and Guillemet have here. Like they actually have witty banter and seem to play off each other in a really cool way. Like Toadstool is like timing his laughs to cut Guillemet off. He actually manages to successfully goad Guillemet into getting closer to the witch hunter, which is very much like a moment of like, okay, Toadstool is not just a regular goblin when you see him manipulating a fairy like that.
Yeah, like Guillemet is acting like Toad's words have absolutely no effect on him, but you can tell he got under his skin here.
Yeah. And, you know, he's a fairy. I suppose you could always sit back and be like, oh, but Guillemet wants him to think it's
working. Yeah.
But, like, I choose to believe that, like, Toadstool seems to be this kind of schemer in a way that's similar to fairies, but obviously quite distinct. Like, he's got this very blunt scheming. Like, yeah, he just sort of directly calls out, well, I'm getting closer to the witch hunter than you. And then he notes that Guillemet starts getting closer to the witch hunter.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I like seeing Toad score points. It's fun. So we jump back in time again. We're going back to the Warrens, and we see the moment when Turd began to become Toad.
Yes. I wanted to talk like a bunch in this part. If nothing else, because like I think we've talked about goblins being kind of like children in some ways. A lot. And so obviously the idea of Toadslow as a goblin who, you know, teaches children feels important. And I love this section in this flashback because it feels very much like that part in like a high school movie or TV show where it's like the kids who are seniors talking about what they're going to do when they finish high school and leave town. Like, Dee Dee is clearly just sort of talking about going to the big city. You know, she's going to get out of this small podunk town of the Warrens. And like Toadslow and Bubblegum are like starting to make their own plans. Like it's just really fun. I guess we track all these stages of Toadslow growing up as we're sort of evaluating some bits of goblin culture and, you know, those links to, because all the stuff about goblin culture being like toxic and everything, like goblins being children fits into that because it's like the environment we're in as children affects who we are when we grow up.
I like this comment by you. I like the idea of this being the, oh, we got to get out of our small town section of a, you know, of you know, high school or whatever. Yeah, I think that's great. I think it's a great way to view these flashbacks that we're seeing. Because, you know, it's hard to determine Toad's age as we go through them, but
yeah,
it's a good, it's the start of his wanting more, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah. It's where he starts to really concretely put together how he's going to get it.
Yes, true.
Yeah, I want to know where this girl Dee Dee brought back ended up too.
Yeah, like, right. We're
talking about where people ended up.
I love this. Dee rescuing this abused child is like heroic in the most goblin-y of ways, right? Because Dee is justifying it or attempting to justify it as covering her tracks, but it feels shallow. Like, that feels like a shallow justification. And it's just kind of her. You know, it reminds me of when it was America Ted's, was it Liberty's Interlude where we dove into that? I can't remember, but all that stuff about like her bonding with Alexander and we were talking about their attachments to the goblins as being these kind of like outcasts of society as they felt they were. And this feels like the same for me for Dee, is like seeing this abused little girl and seeing a kind of like you know, downtrodden and pained existence and therefore wanting to stick up for her. I think that's just great.
Yeah, yeah, it did remind me a bit of Liberty stuff, because you could tell, yeah, as you said, like, Dee has all this stuff where she's like, oh, you know, and then the dad came in and he was like punching her and it was like, it was getting in my way, so I had to deal with it. And it's like, it wasn't getting in your way.
Yeah,
like, you just wanted to do something about it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go so far as to say she has a heart of gold, but she's got a heart. It yeah. grew three sizes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good stuff.
I mean, just the whole scenario is just hilarious as well. Because, like, imagine being this girl and, like, you know, there's this monster that lives under your bed and fucking sells your toys and shit and is, like, torturing you. And then just one night it hops in the bed with you and you must be like, oh, fuck, this is how I die. And then instead it just kills your abusive father. Like, what a ride. And then
this girl, right?
And then this girl's just like, I want to watch cartoons. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
It was a little bit hilarious, but also you're just like, holy fuck, this is tragic. Like, where is this girl now?
Yeah, I definitely want to where are they now on this girl. Because, I mean, timeline-wise, how long ago do you think we are? Like, could this be the origin story for Durocher or something? Like, I'm trying to figure out roughly how old we're meant to figure out they are.
I think he mentions decades since going to the fairy courts, and that was
was after this, huh?
So
maybe dead by now is the answer.
Yeah, or, well, I mean, decades. Durocher could actually be, like, about the right age. I don't know.
Yeah, decades from the fairy court makes me feel like this is about 80 or 90 years.
Oh, and I was thinking more 50.
Mm. Yeah.
Which actually might be too old for Durocher, but yeah. We'll just meet, like, America and Liberty's grandma. And it was that.
Yeah, could be. You never know.
Oh, also, they mentioned frogging, and I just... Like, Dee Dee says she was frogging with the family, which is that, like, do you remember that story? It just, like, scarred me when I was, like, 18. And there was that story about the woman in Japan who lived in the guy's cupboard for, like, a year.
I don't remember that story, but, you know, it seems like it's a horror trope of, like, things living in the walls.
Yeah. No, there was this lady, and it was, like, this guy had a one-bedroom apartment, and he started to notice that his food was going missing, so he installed cameras thinking people were breaking in, and this woman had been, like, living in the top of his kitchen cupboard for, like, a year, and she just came out and, like, took showers and ate food when he wasn't there. And he's watching this footage in the house when he finds that out, like, that's terrifying.
Yeah, you're right, that's pretty horrifying. Yeah, it's it's creepy stuff. So now here's something that we need to discuss. Obviously, Bubble is a character that we see a lot in this, Toad's girlfriend. We don't actually learn their name, but we know that their name, the kind of sanitized version of their name, is Bubble Yum. You've been calling them Bubble Cum, which is the, I think, commonly accepted fandom name for them. But it could be something less gross. It could be, for example, Bubble Bum, and it's already been slightly sanitized.
Whatever you need to tell yourself to sleep at night, I suppose.
No, yeah, it seems to track to me. I like that Wildbird doesn't say it. He just lets our fucked up minds fill it in for themselves.
Yeah, well, it's the same as, like, I don't think we've ever had confirmation what Blunt Munch's actual name is.
Yes.
I have.
We can all kind of guess, right? Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Gashwad would probably be another one. I'm not actually sure what Gashwad's might be.
Gashwad sounds like it could be already just what it is.
Just it.
Yeah.
Yeah, just with, like, the grosser interpretations of some of that, the parts of that name.
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anywho, let's move on. So, yeah, we're back in the present again. Toady is escorting Snowdrop back to Avery and is offering her a job as a goblin sage, which is great. Again, you know, flashing us back to when we were hanging out with the Teds and we saw that other goblin sage. I think Snow would be a great fit for that.
I should definitely be better than the guy with the fake plastic bag beard. Actually, Snowdrop was the one who kept talking that guy up, actually, right? That was, like, the joke at the time in the story, was that Snowdrop kept being like, oh, he's actually super wise. So it'd be kind of funny that she's going to take on the same sort of role.
Yeah.
We get another comment on her her new outfits as well from Toadslaw, because like, this is the second time in a row where when we've seen her, somebody's sort of taken note of the fact that her outfits look more put together. And one of the things that's brought up is she's got like headphones that are like opossum ears. So I'm just really excited for this development in, you know, the inevitable Snowdrop fashion line that Wild Bow will release. Because now we're talking like accessories as well as t-shirts.
Mm, yeah, no, I'm keen. I'm going to get the Snowdrop action figure with the soggy handshake accessory.
Okay, if you want it, I mean, it's all yours. You can have mine.
Yeah, anyway, in this conversation between Toad and Snow, I do love that Toad's advice to Snowdrop is just basically carry a bunch of cool tricks with you, because that's just who Toad Swallow is. He's just a goblin that carries around a bunch of goblin tricks. You know, I mentioned that the soggy boxing glove, that's his weapon form, which is effectively just a kind of Inspector Gadget style glove. I love it. It's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, he gives this advice to people a couple of times in this chapter. Like, it's such his thing. Like, he's got this consistent brand of, like, from that first fight when he was born, he realized that he needed little tricks to win, and he's constantly trying to impart that advice on other people.
Yeah, and I mean, even in his, like, fantasy about the goblin markets that we'll get to, that's the role that he sees himself playing, right? Is this, like... Yeah. This jovial uncle that wanders around the markets winking and giving advice to people.
Yeah, it's why I was a little, like, I honestly wish that
I kind of like Guillemet.
Well, yeah, but I wish we'd gotten that Guillemet interlude, like, to follow this up, because I feel like Guillemet plays off that in a really fun way, because he's kind of been a mentor as well. And, like,
yes,
the thing we see in Toadslaw's head in this chapter is, you know, he's not doing it for some selfish reason. He genuinely seems to like giving people advice,
yeah,
and helping them.
Yeah.
Like so it's like, it's just a really cool part of his personality, and I want to see how that is compared or contrasted with Guillemet.
Mm. Yeah, I'm interested to see that too. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I just love Toad, I trust him a lot more than I trust Guillemet, so I kind of want to see it. Like, yeah, I mean, Toad Swallow's grand plan out in this chapter, and it's kind of like, oh, okay, I mean, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, whereas, like, I've kind of given up on getting a Guillemet interlude, because the next chapter focuses so much on Guillemet from Lucy's perspective. I was like, oh, this feels like we're going to do this here instead of a Guillemet interlude. It would be weird to give him so much attention in Lucy's chapter and then follow it up with an interlude. So I was a bit like, reading 10.3, I was like, oh no, the Guillemet interlude, it's disappearing right in front of my eyes.
Mm. We won't get a Guillemet interlude until it's revealed that he's actually one of the co-conspirators.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's he to me, I read Guillemet as the person who's probably most closely aligned with, like, Team Miss. Like, I'm sure he's got his own other bullshit going on. He's a fairy or whatever, but, like, he seems to be the one who's leaning into what Miss set up the most.
Mm.
Anyway, so we'll get there. We'll get there.
We'll get there. Sorry.
We should talk about Toadslaw's offer to Snowdrop. Because as you sort of talked about before, it feels like it means a lot that he wants Snowdrop to be this person who is, like, the face of the market leadership,
mm,
instead of, like, another goblin.
Mm.
Because she's got goblin aspects to her. I mean, we've talked about that a lot, but she's not a goblin. So it really sort of sets the vibe of this place as a marketplace, that it's not a goblin in charge. It's somebody who is in sync with goblins, but is also in sync with practitioners, and, like, has other parts of aspect to her. She's got nature, you know, she's lost. Like,
mm.
I really like her as a choice for selling what he wants this place to be. It's not the Warrens 2.0. It's not another goblin hub. It's something different.
Mm, yeah, it is. I like it. It's Toad Swallow changing the way that the world is going to work, right? Like, changing the systems.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He wants this place to be, yeah, different to other goblin places. And
yeah.
Putting someone who's, like, part goblin in charge of it is a really cool way to sort of make that goal clear.
Mm.
And again, better guy than Bristow, because he believes in his vision and doesn't want to be the one in charge of it. He's just trying to help set it up for everyone else.
Yeah. He's a hero. There's no doubt about it. So we jump back to the past again. We take a link to the past and we see the Legend of Toad running around catching fairies in glass bottles. It's very Zelda, 100%.
Yeah, exactly. I saw this happening and I was like, well, at least he'll be safe if he runs out of hearts.
What are you going to... Imagine if we get to the point where Toad is like in a fight and almost dies and then just takes out a fairy from a glass bottle and eats it. I would love to see it.
That'd be good.
Bo, I would love to see it. Make it happen. Yeah, there's this line. We jump back and we're watching this fairy. And, you know, it's kind of like it starts out as a bit of a nature documentary. And then we get this line, butterfly wings didn't lend themselves to velocity, however, which is just such a brutal line. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I always forget, but I quite like how, like, fairies with a Y exist in this universe. It's the same as, like, the brownies. Like, there's just so much richness to explore. Like, the idea that, yeah, the fairies we picture from our childhood of, like, little things you could fit in a jar with butterfly wings. It's like, yeah, they exist, and Toad's always going to fucking capture them for some bullshit.
Yeah.
I'm sure they didn't have a pleasant end. Again, we see two fairy in this section, and, like, much more so than Guillaume. God, these two read is just pathetic, like, from Toadsaw's point of view. Like, their shit comes across as fucking Days of Our Lives level so bad.
God, they're terrible. Oh, it's so shit.
Yeah, the moment where the other one's like, oh, but spring leads to tragedy. It's like, wait, no, but that means, like, and Toadsaw interrupting them by making vomiting sounds is just exactly what it deserved. And I really felt that from his perspective.
He literally couldn't help himself. He gives himself away because he just can't. Good
stuff. Like that time where you see, like, a shitty thread on Reddit or on the YouTube comment section, and you're just like, I shouldn't get into this.
Yep, but here we go. Yeah. Yeah, and so Toadie's kind of talking about how he's become, he and Bubble have, their lives have kind of become about the collection of power in a non-traditional goblin way. He's effectively a goblin entrepreneur, right?
Basically. There's this interesting, like, he and Bubble are trying to upset the system. They're like, obviously he's leaning into practitioners and, like, trying to influence the next generation to be better.
Yeah.
Whereas she is, like, even though she can't grow, she's using practitioners to get power over other goblins. It's interesting. It's like they're trying to transition goblin stuff to more brains over brawn. Because usually with goblin stuff, is mentioned a few times in this chapter, like, size is the deciding factor for who's in charge.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, you know, as we were talking about before, it's this Darwinian kind of fight, strength hierarchy, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just interesting that Bubble and Toadsaw are both leaning into the idea of using practitioners to give themselves power outside that. They're like, they're using practitioners to boost themselves.
Yeah. I wonder if it's because, like, Bubble and Toad maybe we don't hear that much about goblins, so we can't really definitively say this, but they have a relationship. They have a boyfriend-girlfriend, as they describe it, relationship, which isn't something that we have heard that much about, right? Like, so they're clearly used to
that too.
Having partners, I guess. So I wonder if that helps them work with practitioners, that they're able to actually, like, I mean, you know, I even if they're not the most considerate, it's hard to be in a relationship without at least having some level of empathy, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I've seen some pretty shit relationships.
Yeah, true.
But no, I tend to agree. It felt like a pretty good relationship. But obviously not perfect. He talks about it being on again, off again in this section. But I came away with the vibe. The way he talks and thinks about her throughout the story, it's sort of like, I get the vibe that it's a relatively healthy relationship. I guess we haven't seen Bubble. Like, hopefully she hasn't turned into a piece of shit with the route she's going down of desperately seeking more power. Yeah, I don't know. I agree. I thought it was interesting. I wasn't sure if goblins ended up in relationships.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not something that we've seen before, right? So who knows?
No, exactly. It just didn't seem like the types, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly right. So we jump back to the present and we see Toadie watching the Kennet others fighting the witch hunter. He's just chit-chatting with Rook and he reveals his grand plans for Kennet, and Lucy overhears.
I love how Crooked Rook and Toad Swallow like sir and ma'am each other. There's this real like feigned dignity. It's, or they're both like ironically doing it or being like, oh, thank you, ma'am. And it's like, oh, no worries, sir. It just adds a really fun vibe to this conversation, similarly to the one with Guillermet before.
Mm. Yeah. yeah, it's, well, I think I, the thing I empathize most with Toad from this chapter was this line that he drops where he says, ma'am, I'm so fucking curious what you're on about, which is just, you know, we can all relate. That's mood.
Yeah. Well, I think, isn't that the first thing he says to Crooked Rook? Like, she comes over and sort of says hi, and he's just like,
yes.
What are you on about?
Way to open the conversation. And, like, I mean, this conversation ends with us having no idea of what Rook's on about, but with us having a strong idea of what Toad's on about. So,
yeah,
you know, another tick on Rook's manipulation checklist.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Again, she doesn't manipulate as much as she just gives him a platform to talk. And
yes.
Toad Swallow likes to talk. He likes to explain things. He was very easy to get this out of.
He's just so friendly.
Yeah. It's one of the early things that comes up in this chapter, this conversation, is Crooked Rook gives us a quick rundown on the two big sides as she sees them. There's obviously the Carmine Throne Takers, who, like, at this point, we're assuming want to turn this into, like, the Carmine Domain and make it a shithole or something. But she refers to John's side as, like, the side of John's peace. Well, Toad Swallow kind of calls it that. And that's interesting, because I definitely left John's interlude with this sense of, like, not quite knowing what his plan was. And this feels like, okay, so he's definitely committing to trying to end that violent cycle he was trapped in. We're still just left here being like, how is he planning to do that?
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah.
I mean, an interesting thing is when the Carmine roll, like in Arc 1, when they were like, oh, can you kill the Carmine Beast? And it was sort of like, oh, fully killing the Carmine Beast is like killing all violence in this whole third of Ontario or whatever it was. And it was like, you know, so that's not something you could do. It's like, well, maybe it's something the Carmine can do. Like, is that what John's, is John very literally going to try and end the cycle of violence by like somehow using his role to like
depower violence rather than amplifying it?
Somehow make it something that in this region becomes something that has less sway, so a Carmine role isn't needed. And I mean, of course, it'd be extra hilarious if he's sacrificing himself.
That's what I was just thinking.
Self-sacrifice play.
Classic John.
So, I don't know. Like, that doesn't feel quite right to me as an idea of, like, just removing violence from the region, because I don't understand how you would do that or maintain it.
I mean, it could just even be as simple as, like, we see that things are getting more and more violent without the Carmine Beast as a way to kind of funnel that. So maybe just by being the Carmine whatever, he would be kind of making it more, I don't know. It doesn't quite track, I don't think.
Yeah, but there's still the whole palatability and stuff. Like,
there's still something we're
missing. Yeah. Another thing Crooked Rook mentions here as well is, like, when Toad Swallow sort of suggests that he's unique as far as goblins go, she says he's rare rather than, like, fully unique. And I just wanted to bring up this line because it really touches on something that I fully enjoy about this story, which is that it's not, like, this story hasn't even pretended to be operating on, like, a global scale and be more epic than everything that's going on in the world. Like, this is very much, yes, there's some crazy shit going on in this segment of Ontario right now, but, like, for all we know, there's, like, way more hardcore shit going on in, like, you know, practitioner Russia or something. Like, it's not, this story isn't redefining the world and, like, has the whole safety of the world as its stakes. It's just this one small segment that will be, at most, I think Miss in 5.D phrased it as, like, a precedent. And I just like that as, like, a story that kind of has defined boundaries for its stakes and is able to operate within them and still feel epic.
Yeah.
But it doesn't need to be, like, if we don't stop this, then the whole world is going to explode.
Mm. Yeah, it's not earth-shattering stakes, but it is important and personal.
Yeah, and it helps the world feel richer to know that, like, all this is going on and this is just this part of Canada. Like, it's not, there's so much to this world that we haven't seen, and I reckon that's cooler.
Yeah, it also lets it feel like there's other stories to be told in this world, you know? I mean, I think a great example is, Ted, one of Bristow's Aware, you know, the one who lived through. Was it Ted? That's right, isn't it?
Yeah. Ted Havens.
Ted Havens, exactly. As this character who should be the protagonist of a story, but we're not seeing that part of it. And I think that's just so great.
Yeah. Yeah, I 100% agree. It's like that whole thing where you don't explain all the mysteries of your world. It's more fun to leave them open. And, like, this story is doing that a whole bunch because we're only covering one small section of one country.
Yeah, we're focused on one fun mystery. So let's get into Toad's, you know, goblin market desires, because obviously there are some problems with it, but, like, one of the biggest things we've seen about Kennet and trying to make Kennet something different, one of the biggest problems we've seen is, like, basically everybody who learns about it, whether they're a practitioner, another, a witch hunter, has a reason to go and fuck it up, right? Like, go and actively destroy it and prevent it from being a thing. This is so far the only idea I've heard that's, like, yes, problematic in some ways, but actually would give it, like, a reason to exist and to be, like, protected by, you know, practitioners or whoever. Like, if it had a function that it was serving that was a bit more tangible, it gives Canada a reason to be around and not just be fucked up by the first practitioner that comes their way.
There's definitely that side of it. I mean, again, like, as Totsalo brings up, a lot of other goblins and fairies will not like this idea. So if it's being sold as the eighth fairy court, I think it would cop a lot of heat. If it's just a goblin market and, like, Toadswallow eases in the idea that it's
which I think is very wise, branding wise,
Sure. I mean, the innocence, I feel like it's the problem here to me, like, Toadswallow, I don't know, the way he phrased it, it gave me the vibe of it's sort of like he wanted to build it on the battlefield, which makes me think, you know, Kennet's 5,000 citizens may not necessarily come out of this as innocents who are still okay.
Yeah, sure. But honestly, like, goblins aren't great, but compared to a lot of the others that we see, they're not the worst, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you could do worse, you know?
You could. I mean, like, I'd pick Toadswallow's plan over, like, Edith's in a heartbeat, for sure.
Yeah.
I think there's room to maybe try and set this up in a way that doesn't take over the town.
Yes, like, hopefully,
Hopefully the fact that Avery's going to know about this via Snowdrop. Oh, no, she's just going
to know. Lucy knows about it now, so.
But Lucy knows. Like, hopefully they can use that to, like, open a dialogue with him and negotiate.
Yeah, find a way to make it tangible and realistic without being too painful for the innocents, sure.
Especially because Rook fucking did this to try and put them at odds, clearly. And so, like, I'd just love it if she had to eat shit on that, because the Kedeteers turned it around and were like, okay, how can we make this work in a way that works for everyone?
Yeah. I'm sure there's a way.
I also just really want to give a shout out and some credit. We obviously had Jay on at the end of Arc 9 as well. And despite that being already the longest fucking episode of anything we've ever made, that conversation went on for about an hour after we stopped recording. And one of the things Jay talked about, they've actually had this theory for a while that, well, I guess not a theory, they've used this framing of goblins being an eighth court in their own live read. So another shout out for Jay's live read, because they clocked onto this months ago. But also, I just particularly wanted to bring it up because it was one of the things they said that didn't make the episode. And
they should get the props for it.
Yeah, like it's now like a canon set of framing. I actually argued against it, and I still kind of do. I think it's right, but it's not the whole story, if that makes sense. Like, I think I mean, that's the great thing about this world, is you can sort of frame things however you like, and they all sort of are as true as we let them be. Like, if Tetsuo got this idea to have momentum, it would probably start to become more true that goblins were the Eighth Court. But I think at the moment it only captures some of the picture.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's... It feels like it's... It almost feels like it's an interpretation of a truth, you know? Like, it's not necessarily the solution. It's just a way you could kind of... A layer you could view the solution through, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a really good way of saying it. Like, because it applies to Tetsuo and you know, some of his friends, but it may not necessarily apply to all goblins. Yeah, like, so, you know, and it's an idea that is worth pursuing, because I think Tetsuo, you know, from the sounds of it, he's trying to create a market that is less toxic than, like, the Warrens. So, it's an idea I'll support, because the more traction we get it, the more true it becomes, the better for everyone. It kind of strikes me as a nice middle ground between, like, where goblins are now and, you know, them being fully healthy people by modern Western standards, which isn't a goal I know they could reach, or maybe whether they should. There's a whole conversation. But I don't know, my own personal take on, like, goblins and fairy, like, my lens through which I view them is sort of like, to me, goblins are, like, representative of all the parts of humanity that we try to, like, leave behind or like discard or hide away. Like, that's why they're associated with the ruins, like the trash heap. They're the things we try to hide away.
You know, shames versus, like, aspirations.
Yeah, exactly. Like, fairies, as their sort of opposite, are like the things we're reaching for. Like, you know, there's different types of fairy, obviously, but, you know, different people aspire to different things. We've got, like, courts that are clearly synonymous with, like, celebrity. We've got these monarchical royalty courts. I think that was High Spring. It's like fairy are all the things we chase and we elevate and we like to pretend that we are and move towards, whereas goblins are like, you know, we don't just walk around naked because we're wearing clothes. and so, like, all the gross body part stuff is big on goblins because it's the things we sort of play down about ourselves. And, like, through this lens, like, if you look at Western civilization now versus, like, back in Victorian times, I think it's safe to say that we've gotten, you know, more into, like, gore and where things like sex are much less taboo.
Yeah, just kind of more realistic about it, or, like, honest about it, I guess.
Yeah. And so, like, the idea of forming an Eighth Court is kind of this idea of, like, being somebody who's a bit more goblin-y is now something more people would aspire to than in the past.
In the sense of not putting up with bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. Like, the Eighth Court kind of being foundational is this idea of, like, again, not representing all goblins, but, this Eighth Court rising up as, like, some of these things are a bit more okay now, so they get their place alongside the fairy as, like, something that people move towards. So, again, not the whole story, but some of it.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, that's what I love about this world, the fact that, like, there's different lenses to view these things, and I think they've all got some validity. That's really cool that Jay managed to just be clever enough to, you know, find one that would later on become canon.
Anything else to talk about from 10.E?
No.
Okay. Let's get into 10.3 then with Lucy. So Lucy enters the building and is just kind of chit-chatting with Guillaume about what's going on while she prepares.
I love how this chapter really opens with Lucy reminding us she's alone right now. Like, because that's a big theme of this chapter, is the lack of team and support that Lucy has right now. And, you know, like, Lucy sort of opens this up by reminding us Verona's away, Avery is, you know, concussed or whatever the fuck. So more than ever, she needs to be able to rely on the Kennet others who she's with to have her back and help her. And that doesn't go so well.
Well, yeah. We'll see how it goes. It's interesting. I mean, it could go worse, I suppose.
Okay. I mean, yeah. most things could. I suppose the other thing as well, not just that she's missing the can of tears, the other thing Lucy thinks of right at the start of this chapter is she's reeling from learning Toad Swallow's plans, which, again, I like how she frames this as it's like, it's not like a complete betrayal. Like, he wasn't working against us, but he had his own motives that he wasn't being upfront with them about. And that's going to sting a little. Like, we talked about in Arc 9 when they were interviewing McKay, and Toad Swallow was one of the ones who was instantly like, yep, I want to work with you guys.
Mm.
And we're like, oh, shit, maybe that means we can trust him. It was like, no, he wants to work with them on his plan that he wasn't telling them about. Like, that's kind of shitty.
It's fine.
So, yeah, I just really liked Lucy's balanced response to this of being like, fuck, this is shitty and I'm kind of mad. But, like, she's acknowledging that he's not the devil now.
Yeah, it's not a grand betrayal, which I like. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Also, side note, again, Lucy is alone. Like, Avery and Verona are gone. Because this story has consequences, I just want to reiterate props to this. I always love this about Wild Boar's writing, that, like, something like Avery getting hit in the head in a fight means that she's out of action for the next fight, which has other consequences. Like, yeah. It's a great way. I love how these stories don't need to have people dying or, like, every fight to be to the death for the to be stakes and consequences to them.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested to see what the fallout from Raph's murder, I guess, is going to be. I have a feeling it's not going to go down well, right?
No, like, I mean, like, Lucy even touches on it at the end of the chapter. She's like, he's part of a whole network of witch hunters. Like,
yeah,
this isn't just going to go away. So, like, him dying is the end of it.
Yeah.
Besides the mess in Kennet, this is going to also draw attention from outside that they're going to have to work together to deal with.
Mm. Yeah. So let's talk about Guillaume, shall we? Guillaume is here, and from the get-go, he is very, very clearly, I guess, just Guillaume-ish is the word for it, right? he's really not giving any straight answers to anything, and I really love how blunt Lucy is, because you really see that it annoys him, and I love that. I'm just really starting to go all in on the Guillaume is actually bad bandwagon.
What's funny is, like, that is where we started. I think we got, like, we never trusted him because he was a fairy. Then I think we got one prediction that was like, Guillaume is good, actually. And the more we thought about it, the more we went into it. And now it's like, it's gone on long enough that you're like, but I'm going to flip again. Mm. Like, because I mean, fuck knows. Like, I'm not going to pretend I'm at all confident on which side he's on. I cling desperately to Guillaume as a goodie because I want it to be true.
No.
I'm not going to pretend it's based in logic.
I have some pretty convincing arguments that we'll get to over the course of this chapter.
Okay.
Well, I think they're convincing.
here, because his whole thing is he feels like he's trying to teach her to fish, not give her a fish sort of deal. That's the case he's making anyway.
Mm.
He has this whole big speech here about how, you know, all these previous fights that I've been in have prepared me for this one. Like, you need to make sure you're learning lessons and bringing these forward with you as you grow. Like, he's trying to explain to her in his indirect fairy way why he doesn't want to just tell her stuff. He's like,
yeah, it is fun, despite how much I think he is evil and I can't get behind him. I cannot support him.
Well, because the interesting thing is, in both of his examples that he gives to her of, like, comparisons to this fight, the villain is not the person who matches to Raph in the metaphor.
Mm.
Like, so his two examples, one is when he fought another fairy in this spider's domain, and, like, Raph is the spider in that one, but
yes, the actual not enemy the person is the being other fairy. Yeah.
And similarly, like, he talks about the Wraith and how the Wraith was laying all these social connections in the court, which, again, just fucking cool little story. But, like, also, yeah, the Wraith wasn't the enemy in that. It was the person who made the Wraith and had it as part of their plans. Like, it's in both of these stories, he's, like, telling her, like, oh, this fight is just like this other fight. And it's like, in both of them, Raph is not the villain that you need to be worried about, Lucy.
He's the set dressing to the larger problem.
Yeah, she doesn't seem to make that connection. And, like, you could just tell Gilbert's probably like, oh, God, please, just say it.
Well, maybe if you just said it, Guillaume.
Oh, he couldn't do that because then he's just giving her a fish. You know?
Yeah.
And that would be, you can't ever give fish. You only ever teach fishing.
Yeah.
Final Guillaume thing, because as I said, I think this is at the cost of his interlude, the attention he gets in this chapter. He mentions how the Winter Court is littered with fairy who like focused on a single thing, like swordsmanship or whatever, because it was like once you do solve it and you sort of can, then there's nowhere to go, so you fall to winter. And obviously, since Guillaume is falling to winter right now, it leads me to wonder, like, do you think there was something that Guillaume tried to solve a puzzle or become the best in the world at, and that was, and now he's like reaching that point, and that's how he'll fall to winter?
Yeah. I wonder. There doesn't seem to be anything that's like when you think about Guillaume, what's his shtick, you know?
It's like mentoring is the idea that comes to my mind, just because he's sort of been doing it with Lucy and Avery. I feel like the big clue here is, he, remember he had that guy who he was in love with, and he's technically here because he's mourning that guy?
Mm.
Is that something? Like, is he like...
He's the best lover in the world.
Yeah, well, the best in the world at like feeling compassion or something. That would tie into Lucy's current business. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so interested to watch Gil fall to winter, because I feel like that'll be the moment where he suddenly makes sense in a very tragically awesome way.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, you know, the metaphor of being the best in the world at something and then falling to winter from that reminds me of Inigo Montoya in The Princess Bride, who's the best sword fighter in the world and is so good at sword fighting that he is bored and becomes a drunkard. And I wonder if that's what Guillaume has in store. We'll see.
Yeah, because weren't we told the Kenneteers won't like him when he falls to winter? That was something that Fortune Teller said in Arc 8, right?
Yeah.
Have I made
who
that
knows?
Up?
No, definitely. But who knows what that means?
Yeah, exactly.
pale.txt. Lucy sets up a barrier to stop Chloe from escaping into the wider Kennet, if it comes to that. And the girl by candlelight is not happy about it.
I love how fleshed out this rune system is, that it's actually really fun to follow Lucy as she like goes through the puzzle of like, how do I draw a rune that targets Chloe? I think we talked about this last week, but again, it's just something Pale has really excelled at compared to like other book series I've read have had entire magic systems that feel less developed than just the one in this one. And we're still learning stuff. Like, we get descriptions of the runes for the major forces, like fate and time and stuff. It's cool.
I know you love the rune puzzles.
I really do. Like, I had fun. There was a Reddit thread a couple of days ago on like what the symbol for the coin might be, because Lucy brings it up but doesn't actually tell us what the symbol is. Mm. So it was really fun sort of trying to puzzle together with people what the symbol for the coin might be.
Who knows? Thoughts in the discussion thread, I suppose.
Yeah. If you have ideas, please let us know. So back to the debate, like, that Edith actually brings up here, because it's worth talking about, because I think Edith's not wrong. I mean, I think she's arguing in bad faith, and I think Lucy's more correct, but Edith's concern isn't invalid.
Mm. Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's, I get that it sucks, but, like, I don't know. This is the world that we're in, right?
I mean, yeah, but like, you know,
what does Edith want in this situation? You know, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing, right? It's like, because it does suck for her, because Lucy can just go around and draw these diagrams and it can completely fuck one of them up, and it's like, takes her a minute to set up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is, yeah, I mean, like, I can understand why that pisses her off, but they're like, as you said, like, every time she sort of brings it up, Lucy has good up reasons. Like, it's sort of like, oh, you know, Chloe might be uncomfortable if she gets contained. And Lucy's like, Chloe would probably be even more uncomfortable if she got out and killed people.
Mm.
And it's like, I think we know enough about Chloe that I feel comfortable siding with Lucy on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so too.
So it's like, I think Lucy's more correct, but I get, like, I guess Edith's core concern here is super understandable to me, that like, it sucks that someone like Lucy can just walk around and very easily draw these diagrams that that could totally ruin her life.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. That is a fair worry. And that's why being an other is so painful and dangerous. But, you know,
yeah.
Like, what do you want, Edith? What do you want her to do?
Yeah, I think, like, Lucy makes a pretty good case for, I'm trying to do this in the right way. And we see it at the end of the chapter. She has that moment where, after everyone stabs each other in the back and she almost gets got by Chloe, she's tempted to just draw a line around the whole fucking factory and just lock them in there. And she, like, has that moment of, like, no, that would be a shitty thing to do. And I was like, oh, thank God. Like,
yeah. It would be, but oh, I'd love to see that kind of interrogation scene.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, I don't know. Like, I get what Edith's saying here. And it's like, you can see, like, it's this fear and that thinking that has probably led her to do all this shit with the Carmine first. Because it both is and isn't an irrational fear that she has.
Yeah. I mean, it's a rational fear, but maybe, like, extrapolated to a level of irrationality, I guess.
Just as an aside, while we're talking about the furs, something that's been on my mind for this entire arc is I really did assume that when Verona stole the furs, like, Edith and co. would, like, kick things up a notch, because it would be like, you know, oh shit, we've lost the furs, like, we need to get them back. So I've been surprised at how the town has still felt like things are normal.
Mm.
And it's like, that's the reason I actually think there's probably a good call for the prediction that somebody in Kennet hired the witch hunter. Just because, like, you could see Edith and Marisica being like, oh shit, we lost the furs, we need to shake the town and, like, see what rustles up.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, it feels like losing the furs should have been a huge deal to them. And they've been remarkably good at keeping their cool.
Well, Edith/GBC has really kind of gone off the deep end, I think, in the past few chapters. But other than her, yes.
But how much of that is just the fact that we're seeing more of it now? Like, that was stuff being kept away from the Kenneteers. We were at the Blue Heron Institute for a long time since she took charge.
Maybe, like, I don't know. I feel like Edith wasn't this overtly villainous before now.
Yeah, but how much of that is, like, just the shift in perspective on the story and the fact that since it's been confirmed from us, we're viewing it through that lens. Because we didn't see stuff. Like, there was that time in Arc 5 where the barrier was down and she was just straight up obliterating and burning everything that came through the barrier. I remember we called it out. We're like, oh, shit, that's a bit intense, Edith. Maybe, you know, take a chill pill. And it's like, she's been doing this stuff for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
So, yeah, I don't know. I just, yeah, I'm impressed at how much they've kept their cool. And so learning that they actually hired Raph would make sense to me.
Yeah, true. As a way to kind of, bust up the town a bit.
Yeah. And this is a bit of a weird point that I want to bring up here. So Lucy's drawing this rune thing, and she's using the symbol for death a bunch. And so she puts on some music, and she sort of links the concept of death to the men in her life in this really tragic way. Like, the topic of death for her brings up, like, the, like, Timon, who she's, like, a little attracted to, and, like, you know, Guillemay and John as, like, guys who keep seemingly chasing death. And it's just, I don't know, with that and, like, you know, obviously the tragedy of her father dying while she's young, it was just this moment for me where I was like, God, you know, like, Lucy associating the concept of men and manlyhood with death to a degree, like, makes this tragic amount of sense, because with the exception of Booker, all of the, like, men in her life do have a very, like, messed up relationship with death. And I guess that's just sort of important to her as somebody who is, like, you know, straight and sees herself having a husband. The fact that, like, her idea of masculinity and what she would potentially look for in a partner is tied into that is, like, I was really glad to see
her brother, I guess.
Well, that's the thing. She lists Timon here as, like, being associated with that death energy for manliness that she sort of has in her head. And she's like, yeah, that's not healthy for me. I'm going to steer away from that. And it's like, yeah, like, I'm glad that, like, Booker is this sort of positive masculinity ideal in her life. And it's like, that is definitely, you know, the direction she needs to lean into.
Yeah. I guess that's a thread to track.
Yeah, just like the amount of times Tymon has been mentioned, like he's going to be back in the story, right?
And so he does get, he's occupying a lot of space in Lucy's head, isn't he?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's interesting because like I feel like the vibe she sets up here is that, yeah, she maybe is a little drawn to him, but in a way that she knows isn't good for her. And, you know, with someone like, we haven't seen Wallace since the two of them made out in the party in like arc four. So like, yeah, I don't know, that'll just be interesting to see if that sort of thread of Lucy and her knowing what she wants out of a partner is going to go somewhere.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on it, I suppose. So yeah, Lucy heads back inside and starts dismantling some of the witch hunter's traps.
Yeah, and like, are we sure Raph doesn't have some sort of time manipulation ability? Because like his ability to set up these networks of traps is insane.
There was that part last chapter when we were with Toad Swallow where Toad was like, oh, this whole eastern third of Canada is just his now. And I was like, whoa, he's been busy.
Like it's insane. It's like, I'm glad they managed to stop him.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in how they stopped him. It was like they stopped him and then it's like, there's a whole contingent of these guys? Like, fuck.
Yeah, I guess...
I hope Raph was their prodigy.
We don't really know how long it's been, but I don't get the sense it's been anything more than, like, a small handful of days, right?
I got the impression this was, like, the end of the same day. Because Totsuo sort of mentions he woke up at, like, 5 a.m., which is where we saw him end with Alpi in her nightmare. And so then it was like, it's been at like two thirds of a day since then, is my read.
Yeah, true.
Which is just insane. Like, yeah, Kennet must be small. I couldn't even cover two thirds of my town in a day.
Yeah, it's he's quick. He's quick with them bells and strings.
Also, Gilmay drops a line here where he's like, oh, this guy's unable to jump from windows. And I was like, that's a good callback to that girl who got
yes, to that time when he saw someone die jumping out a window. Yeah.
Funny reference.
So another part that's worth noting, Guillaume tells Lucy about one of the trap wires, but not the other one. Guillaume trying to get Lucy killed? Probably not, but still, sus.
I think he's just really, really big on teaching people to fish. yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really like this segment in general. Like, I came into this chapter sort of expecting a big action-packed fight against the witch hunter, but honestly, Lucy doesn't come into contact with him at all. Like, so we spent a third of this chapter with her securing the perimeter, and then this like next third is dedicated to like her and Guillaume just sneaking around, disarming traps, and like it's a really different type of tension to what I was expecting, but it's still like, I was on the edge of my seat because it's just like at any moment it feels like some trap could go off and blow their face in, you know?
Yeah. I mean, 100%, yeah. It's very, very tense.
Yeah, but like, yeah, very different energy of tension because it's like her slowly sneaking through like fucking Kevin McAllister's like House of Horrors.
Yeah, maybe that's Raph's actual origin story. Yeah.
He was left home alone.
I
think the idea of her walking around this space, it fits into so much of what she's talked about with not conceding ground and like her arenas and stuff. Like she establishes the perimeter here, she's like reclaiming the spaces that he's trapped, and then later on we're obviously going to see her like, she explicitly disarms one of the traps by like consuming it in her glamour to the point where she can claim the area like Alpi did a couple of chapters ago. It's really cool how this chapter takes a totally different direction to what I was expecting, but uses that to still lean into what we know about Lucy.
Yeah, you're right. It's very cool. This like taking over the space in a very cool way.
Yeah. And because that's just how Lucy thinks about a lot of this stuff. So it's great to see.
So here's something that's worth noting. There's a bit where Chloe has entered the space and is kind of like, everyone's keeping an eye on her and making sure she doesn't go too crazy. and there's a part where she starts losing it a bit. And then Edith is the one who tries to talk her down, right? Which,
yeah,
I think is important, right? Because Edith, surely Edith does want Chloe to attack Lucy in this situation. And that's the outcome that, that would have happened if Edith hadn't, like, done this. So is Edith good, actually?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the times where Edith has felt like a nice mum to the Kennedys.
Yeah.
And we know that at least the Edith part of the Girl by Candlelight is interested in having children.
Mm.
I think that's been mentioned.
Yeah.
So it could be that part won out for a sec. I mean, there's also the thing, I think Edith doesn't, she does need plausible deniability. Like, if Lucy dies here and then Verona comes back and is like, did you do everything you could to stop it? And Edith's like, well, no, I actually kind of let it happen. She's going to get forsworn pretty damn quick, right?
Sure, I suppose.
So she needs to be able to at least say she did what she could, and maybe this is just that. And she's like, you know, I mean, obviously another moment comes up for her.
Yes, almost immediately later, Edith is kind of directing Chloe away from people with his bursts of flame, but doesn't do it to protect Lucy. So it gets undone pretty quick, but it still just stood out to me, I guess.
Yeah, so I'd be interested if, like, from Edith's perspective, there was, like, more of a defensibility for letting Chloe go towards Lucy that second time, where she'd have more of a defense she was able to put up.
Yeah, yeah, maybe, maybe. I don't know. It just felt interesting. Felt important that she was, like, actively de-escalating there. So yeah, the net starts tightening around the witch hunter, and Chloe jumps into action, attacking Lucy and freeing Raph.
And this is sort of really the moment where, like, we've been talking this whole chapter about, like, how things aren't quite gelling, and this is, like, the moment where Lucy's like, this is a clusterfuck, because this is the part where it's the opposite of teamwork and it all hits the fan. Yeah, I mean, like, this whole arc has been about establishing the quote-unquote teams in Kennet.
Mm.
And this is, like, now the chapter that's really starting to deliver on that concept, because we've just gone through, yeah, five perspectives of people who are on different sides in this conflict, and now we're seeing that element of the town come to fruition with everyone fucking playing games and shit while this fight's going on and it's costing injuries and lives.
Mm. Yeah, it's it really becomes chaotic, right? I mean, yeah. I guess it's always been that. We've seen some goblins have died. We know Blunt's pretty injured. I mean, basically everyone gets pretty injured, right?
Yeah, well, like, Nibble's missing half a leg. Chloe. Yeah.
Chloe's fucked up so bad. Oh, man.
There's a part of her still in there, luckily. So I haven't given up hope, but it's like, remember in 10.C where Chloe was having her, like, oh, in a couple of hundred years, it's all going to be great. It's like, I feel like we've added 300 or 400 years to that tally. Like, Crooked Rook's offer is probably looking more appealing now.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, it just hurts because, yeah, we've spent this whole arc exploring sides to see all of their stupid games blow up in our faces as Lucy is kind of like, one of the things that has defined this story to me and that I've really loved about it is, like, the fact that the Kennedys are a really good team.
Yeah.
So it's always like this story has trained me to expect people to actually come together and work well in the end. And so just watching everyone here do the fucking opposite of that just, like, made my blood boil. I was like, oh, I hate you all.
Yeah, it's pretty rough,
head out of your asses for 5 minutes.
And this bit with Chloe is just so sad. There's a moment when Lucy, as Chloe is kind of, like, desperately trying to get at Lucy in the truck, when Lucy sees tears in Chloe's eyes, and it's just so heartbreaking. And then Lucy kind of gets through to her, which is brilliant. It's a very Avery move, and I loved it.
Yeah, well, it's like she comes at it from compassion first. Like, she has that.
Yeah.
The fight leaves her. I think that's one of the really interesting things is, like, one of the comments she makes as Chloe approaches her is just, like, all of her lessons with Guillaume fall away from her. Like, she becomes, the term useless feels harsh, but it's like, you know, she isn't able to defend herself with all her training. She kind of falls apart a bit, and it's this moment where, like, I had been picturing till this point Chloe the ghoul as, like, this, you know, angry beast, like a bull sort of thing, like, angrily charging around, and then we get this look at her and it's like, no, Chloe's way more tragic than that. It's like, she's it's not anger, it's like desperation. Like Chloe's, you know, we saw in 10.C in her head when things like the shower turns on, she's still in there and she's reliving the worst parts of her life. Like Chloe's presumably at this point just having terrible flashbacks and is confused and hurt. And it sucks seeing her like attacking Lucy in this moment, and you can't even just write her off as a mindless beast. We know that she's in there and she's suffering as she's doing this.
It's just kind of sad. I'm glad Wildbo gave us the interlude first so that we could really get into Chloe's head and really feel how terrifying and terrible this would be.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
No. The Witch Hunter emerges from the building and is escaping until Marisica, under guise of Melissica, catches him and kills him.
It was so funny because, like, Melissa appears on the scene and she's running, and, like, I was like, huh, that's impressive. I didn't know she was able to run already. That's good for Melissa. And then it turned out to be Marisica and Glamour. I was like, God fucking damn it. Like, how many times am I going to fall for this bullshit?
Mm.
So sick of Glamour tricking me.
Mm. Yeah, you got caught. So this is where Lucy's ruminating around who's behind this and what's been going on. And so this is, I guess, where we'll dive into it.
Okay.
Because I think a good thing to think about whenever you think about who could be behind something is who has benefited, right? One thing Lucy calls out is the people that she suspects as not involved are the ones who get injured, which could be a good thing to take note of. But
yeah, well, sorry, we didn't touch on it, but Guillemet cops a blow and a half here.
Yes.
Courtesy of Edith.
Yes. Obviously that's a strike against Guillemet being behind it, unless he just wanted Lucy to think that. But yeah, anyway.
That's what they want us.
Yeah. But I specifically want to examine, like, Guillemet and Marisica and, like, where the relationships with them and the Kenneteers stand after this, right? So Guillemet was fighting with Raph and obviously had moments with Lucy to potentially get closer to her while Marcy was kind of being held off. And then also was the one who came in and did the most monstrous stuff that Lucy couldn't even bear to watch, right? So definitely it felt to me like Guillemet was the friendly one and Marisica was the one who was committing the murder, which just feels so on the nose to me that it can't just be, like, it feels like it's a ploy by potentially Guillemet, who I, of course, think is guilty, to, like, have him be in the good graces of the Kenneteers while making Marisica feel like she's a dangerous person not to be trusted. Like, it just feels so, it just has to be a trick, right? It's too much.
I mean, I'm going back to what I was saying in the very first episodes of this podcast, where I'm going to check out of these levels of mind games with Fairy and with Wildbo, because I know that Wildbo and the other Fairy are all operating at a level way above what I can even dream to be at. So, like, with this stuff, I've got too obvious isn't a clue for me, because is it too obvious, or is it too obvious that it's too obvious? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, again, we can go down that rabbit hole forever, right?
Exactly.
And then we have the other culprit from this is the person who smudged the diagram. Yeah.
And again, like, there's probably like 10 candidates for that one that I would feel confident putting money behind.
Yeah.
Like, Edith, again, feels obvious. Matthew was present in Toad Swallow's version of this opening, but we didn't see him at all. So, like, Matthew's on the list. Crooked Rook is another obvious contender. Guillemet is actually possible if you want to lean in that route. Like, there's so many people this could have been.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I feel like Edith is the obvious candidate, but too obvious for it to have just been her, right?
Yeah, this is one of those ones where I'm like a little more confident in being like, no, that one's too obvious.
Mm.
We didn't talk about, there's a great moment where Lucy's explaining the things to Edith and she's like, oh, don't worry, they can be disabled by saying my surname. And Edith just immediately goes, Ellingson. And Lucy's like, I haven't drawn that part yet, you fuckwit. Like, so good.
Yeah. good chapter. I really like this chapter. It's a great keeping things moving while also adding another level to the mystery kind of chapter.
Yeah, like, yeah, this chapter, again, it feels like the one that's starting to take what Arc 10 has been giving to us and really using it in a way for the characters. Like, Lucy is seeing what a mess this is, and she ends this chapter very much thinking, like, we have to do something about what just happened here. Like, this is unacceptable. Mm. So as well as, like, you know, presumably the rest of the arc will be dealing with the cleanup of this witch hunter stuff, but, like, also Lucy's going to have to start thinking about what to do. And she's going to have to try and rope Avery and Verona in at some point.
Mm.
I mean, again, speaking of Verona, like, what? I mean, at a certain point, Wubba's going to have to give us more Verona content, right? Like,
I mean, maybe she just never comes back to the story. Yeah.
Don't say that.
Eventually, surely. But not
I'm
yet.
I'm just wondering if there'll be some sort of, like, recompensial, like, Verona mini arc.
Yeah, Verona gets her own full arc.
Not like a whole arc, but yeah, like, definitely, like, I feel like at least a long-ass chapter.
Mm. Mm.
It's like, what's happening with her dad? What's this process?
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll have to see it eventually. So we'll see, I guess.
I mean, yeah, I can't wait.
But yeah, that's the end of these chapters to discuss. But it's not the end of our episode. We've got more stuff to discuss, starting with some Pale predictions. Predictions left by our community in our Pale Predictor form. Elliot, do you want to pull out your prediction first?
Sure. I've got a prediction from Gart Fohammer, who is basically dropping the prediction that they think Matthew took the doom as a familiar.
Mm.
They cite the evidence that Avery and Snowdrop can share each other's sight, and Matt is able to do this with the doom. Like, he can see using doom sight. And then they basically also tie into the back in the Famulus text in Arc 6.
Mm.
There was talk of proportionate practitioner-familiar relationships, which are the ones that are carefully managed out of necessity, striving to strike the right balance that does not veer too far one way or the other.
Mm.
Which sounds like the situation Matthew's in. So yeah, maybe, like, in addition to hosting the doom, like, to really solidify their connection, maybe Matthew was able to take the doom as a familiar.
Hmm. What's the end result of that, though?
I mean, it would suggest a more, like, it's a stronger bond between Matthew and the doom.
And a bond that kind of ties them together more actively in a way that means they can't just be antagonistic towards each other, I suppose.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie to you. I don't give this theory super high chances, but, I mean, it'd be very fun if it turns out to be right. Like, it's not impossible. And, I mean, you know, most of my predictions end up being wrong. So if I predict this one's wrong, it's chances just went straight up.
Mm. Yeah, cool.
What about yours?
I put out a prediction from Mrs. Evil Doom, whose prediction is, instead of falling to winter, Guillaume will transform himself into a goblin, confirming Toadswallow's Eighth Court theory. I love it. I think it's probably a bit too on the nose for Wubba to actually do it, but I do just really like the idea. And, you know, we need some kind of resolution to Guillaume's fall to winter, which has been talked about so much in the story. And I'm kind of more on board with the Guillaume secretly bad train, which is probably mutually exclusive with this, but I do just think it's a great theory.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it doesn't feel like we've seen the end of Toadswallow's, like, lens to view goblin fairy relationships. But I mean, obviously, it's going to be very interesting to see how the Kenneteers try to interact with him now that Lucy knows.
Mm. Yeah. 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 It will be interesting, won't it? We'll have to see.
Like, because if Guillaume is still a member of Kennet, and Kennet becomes this market, and Guillaume falls to winter and is, like, to quote Toadsoy, the opposite of a goblin, like, what does that mean for his role in that court?
Mm. Yes, I don't know. I don't know the answers to any of these questions. I guess we'll just kind of have to see, right? Because it's like, it's the kind of things where, you know, I don't think we know firmly enough about the rules of, I mean, you know, Toadsoy mentioned this Eighth Court thing, but like you mentioned, it doesn't feel like it's a hard and fast, oh, this is the way the world works. It just feels like a interpretation, right? So who knows what this would actually tangibly be?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So next, let's get into some answers to our discussion question. We've been running a discussion question for the past fortnight, as we do every fortnight. And let's pull out some answers. So our discussion question was, how the fuck can someone help Melissa? I honestly thought we were going to get an answer to this question by the time these chapters had come out, but we haven't. So let's dive into it.
No, it feels like the story's made progress in that regard, but it's not like...
It's not resolved, is it?
Yeah, like checked off, yep. Sort of thing. Which, I mean, this is pale. It feels naive to think something's just going to be checked off like that, unless you're Raf, I suppose.
Mm.
He got checked off pretty hard this chapter.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so should we... which answers did you like that you want to pull out?
I wanted to call out I'm easily impressed's answer,
mm-hmm.
Straight up, because basically... I'm easily impressed, divided the concerns around Melissa into two aspects. You've got her physical well-being and her emotional well-being.
Yeah.
And I really like this answer just because that sort of immediately cuts to the core about what's really fun with this question, which is that, like, those two parts are really at odds. Like, in terms of her physical well-being, you got to get Melissa out of here. Like, Kennet is like, accelerating her descent into being... the bad kind of aware.
Yes.
And having problems.
Yeah.
So getting her the fuck out is physically what's good for her. But like emotionally, we really weren't in these last 2 weeks. Melissa is lonely as fuck. She needs support from people who she thinks are genuinely caring about her.
Yeah.
She
needs something to do. She needs a purpose, right?
Well, yeah. And she needs a group. And I think like shoving her away from everyone she knows is not the way to get her into a group.
Mm.
And that's what I'm easily impressed talked about as well. And I thought this was a really good answer for just immediately highlighting to me what's like fun in the fairy sense about this whole problem. And I mean, I'm still sticking by my theory from last week that having her become a witch hunter that's somehow involved in things is a good solution. So I like this because it fulfills both of I'm easily impressed's things. Like we physically remove her from the situation, but add her to a group and she knows she's got the Kenneteers to fall back on.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting. The physical and emotional parts being in conflict, I like. I think it like the best possible thing for Melissa is if she had just forgotten about it, right? But that is just 100% not what she expresses that she wants. And so it feels kind of shitty to be like, no, but the thing that's best for you is this thing that you've complained against and clearly would hate, but it's still the best option.
I suppose something we need to really give airtime to is the idea that that just actually wasn't an option.
Mm.
Like the reason Melissa has been free falling down this slope of awareness is because she had nothing else. Like her whole life was falling apart. And so it's like, as long as there was nothing else, there was just no way that she could forget. And this is basically what she kept telling us. And we just really weren't listening because she's being such an asshole about everything else. But I think it's almost unfair to say that that was an option because I don't think it was because she couldn't take it because she'd switch herself off, but then she'd be just as miserable and in such a terrible state, she probably would have slipped right back into it.
Mm. Yeah.
Like without these, without some other changes, I just don't think it actually was an option.
Mm. Yeah, maybe you're right. I want to pull out a response from Beleg Tal, who did a great, a lyric rewrite of the song Maria from Sound of Music. And a lot of these lyrics didn't have to be changed that much to make a lot of sense for Melissa. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I have not seen that, so I just thought this was a weird poem.
You haven't seen really the Sound of Music, Elliot?
No.
I mean, it's, you know, you don't need to, but it's surprising that you haven't.
My mum's been trying to get me to do it for years.
Mm.
I don't know. I'm glad you're here because I was just like, this is a weird poem that Melly Tal sent you to us. And then you're like, this is the lyrics from the song. It's like, okay, this makes sense now.
Just a random poem about Melissa.
Yeah, and it didn't like... I was like, this doesn't offer any solutions on how to fix her. I don't understand this.
This does not compute.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. I also wanted to call out to Sarwat's answer, who basically sort of sees what's already happened in these last 2 weeks as a potential solution. And they sort of dive into what they think needs to be done to make her okay? Like, so now that she is sort of going to just be an aware, like, how do we make her happy while she's in that? And, you know, doing stuff like telling her she's valued, not being, like, not being rude to her, all this stuff. But, like, I think the part that I really liked from this answer was their third point, which is make sure Melissa has control of her life and has a say in things, because that's a huge part of what she's been missing recently. Yeah. And I like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, fair enough. I think Dancing Anatolia had a great answer as well, effectively pointing out, like, the ship has kind of sailed for Melissa in some respects, right? Yeah. She's guaranteed to have lost. She's close enough to aware that she's losing all her defenses, right? So she's, regardless of what happens, she's pretty screwed. And therefore, the solution must include her learning how to defend herself against the magical world that she is now a part of. So that needs to be part of the solution. Ergo, practitioner, being protected by practitioners, whatever it is, the ship has sailed on her not being a part of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, fair. I think he's probably right. Yeah. I suppose, I don't know. It's just, I feel like awakening her is not actually a solution that ends well for anyone, including Melissa.
Yeah.
At this stage.
Yeah. I agree.
And then the last answer I quickly wanted to pull out was from Ruben307, but I don't think that's actually you, Ruben. I think it's a different Ruben. This one was spelt without an E.
This wasn't me. I wish.
So the third 107th Ruben suggests sending Melissa to the Witch Hunter School. And I like this answer because that's what I've been saying too. So I finally found a Ruben who gets it.
Yeah, okay. Burn on me.
Got him.
Got me. Thank you, everyone, for your discussion question answers. We have a new discussion question, an interesting one. So the question is, if Kennet as a town is about redefining roles and society, where might the Witch Hunters fit in? I'm interested in this one because, you know, yeah, Kennet is this place of, like, we've talked about it being a model for change that could propagate throughout the entire world. And it obviously relates to the ways that practitioners and others interact. What about Aware? What about Witch Hunters specifically? What's their role?
Yeah, because we talked about this last week and we couldn't quite make it click. So it just feels like the perfect thing to open up to everyone else to see what their ideas are. Because it's, they feel like they have some role to play. They're a force. They're like, you know, they're acting as jury and executioner at the moment. Or so how should they fit in somewhere like Kennet going forward, I think is a really interesting question.
So leave your answers to that in our discussion thread, which you'll find linked in the show notes down below. But that's it for the show now, Elliot.
Well, we are going to be doing a Backed to Pact after this outro. So if you've read Pact, stay tuned.
Yes.
So put down that remote. that's from TV.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, thank you for joining us, everybody. If you want to talk about these chapters we covered or this episode or the show in general, you can do that by diving into our discussion thread, the place where you can also leave your answers to that discussion question.
Yes, you can also follow us on Twitter. Just search Power Reflections. It's where the live reads happen. It's where you find out cool news as well, like how we just released the public-facing feed of our other show, The High Ground.
Yes. Yeah, you can now catch episodes of The High Ground, which was Patreon exclusive, but it's now available for everybody. But you're 6 months behind, so there's still an incentive to go and become a patron. You can get 6 extra months of show.
Yeah, and obviously, like, we're moving on to different movies and stuff, so it's like the patrons are the ones who are actually, like, working off the current show to help us decide where we go next. So yes. It's like, you know, it gets you on the ground floor and helps you sort of shape the show as well as, you know, listen to it.
Yep. But having said that, it's a great show. It's consistently the one that I think I have the most fun recording because it gets very ridiculous. So yeah, check it out and hopefully you'll enjoy it.
Yes. So you can find that. I'll put a link to that in the show notes for this week.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's available in your podcatchers now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if you want to, we already mentioned the Patreon. If you want to get more episodes of The High Ground, you can go to the Patreon and support us at the Doof Troop level at patreon.com/doofmedia.
Yep, and don't forget to head to patreon.com/Wabo while you're there. Give him some money. Otherwise, he'll hire a witch hunter to come get you.
Yes, he will. And then have that witch hunter murdered. Anyway, should we go back to Pact?
Yes. So get out of here if you haven't read Pact.
Yep.
I mean, I suppose you can, like, legally.
Legally, can we stay. Can't come after you. Our lawyers have made it clear, yeah.
But, like, you shouldn't.
Mm.
Anyway. Okay, now that the non-pacties are gone, I mean, this is really more of a back to poke, poke to poke.
Yep, okay.
Because, yeah, I mean, we've got to talk about the fact that Didi showed up for this chapter.
Yeah, I was very excited to see Didi. Man, Didi, so great. This is before poke, right? Like, that's what it feels like to me.
She's mentioned as being adolescent in the flashback that she's in, which says to me that it's like, and she's only just started going above ground. So I don't know how far is between this and poke, but it feels like, you know, this is the lead up.
Mm.
Like, obviously, she's always had a knack for getting into situations with humans.
Yeah, indeed. But yeah, I was very keen to see Didi. What a fun character. And this story about her rescuing the abused child was just so heartwarming. God, Didi, so great.
It was such a good cameo because it was like, it fit in seamlessly. Like, I think aside from people who don't know how to do comments on Reddit and stuff, like, there's nothing in the text to make you be like, oh, this must be a character from somewhere else. I think she fits in really well. And we talked about how this was the 100th chapter. And I think this was a bit of a present to us from Wabo, like, for poke readers. Be like, get a nice little cameo in the 100th chapter. It was really cool.
Mm. Yeah, it's a good cameo. I liked it.
It just felt like her. I think that was what I really liked about it. I was like, oh, that's definitely Didi.
Yes.
This idiot came back to the Warrens with a human
baby. With a human baby. It's classic Didi. Yeah. classic Didi.
I suppose while we're here in Back to Pact, like, so this is some stuff we would have probably touched on a few episodes ago, but it wasn't worth it alone. Obviously, speaking of poke, the milkmaid showed up a while ago. That was a poke thing. I think it was a word of God thing before that, but I'm not familiar with word of gods.
It was a word of God, then showed up in poke, and now in pale, and next in the as the protagonist of Wabbo's new work.
Oh god, what's that gonna be?
What's it gonna be? I can't think of anything.
I'm trying to think of, like, a synonym for, like, draining, but starts with P. Yeah.
Oh, wait. It'll be also called pale, but P-A-I-L.
Yes. Got it in one.
We got there. We got there, folks. All right.
No, that was fun, because, like, in Pope, she just briefly comes up, and it's like, this is a bit weird, some bogeyman-looking thing in the Warrens, and Dee's like, I got the idea from the milk for our baby from her, and it's like, that's a line that has a whole new set of context.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, God.
Like, in poke, I read that as, like, she's the milkmaid. It put the word milk in Didi's head.
Mm.
Now I'm more familiar with her whole shtick. I'm like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So what else should we go back to Pact about? Anything else that we want to catch up on?
I mean, obviously, the witch hunters, we didn't call it out, but... Yes. The lighthouse had Seminego, or however you say his name, in it. That's Andy's mate who gave him the rocket launcher.
Yes, known to be a level-headed and responsible individual doling out rocket launchers. Although, in fairness, that rocket launcher did come very much in handy.
Yeah, although, in anti-fairness, Andy was going to use that rocket launcher to blow up all the practitioners in town, was his original plan. Although. Yes.
Although he did end up using it to save the day, kind of.
And also knowing the Jacob's Bell practitioners, I'm not sure how much I want to judge Andy for that being his original plan.
Fair actually. Enough, hey.
They were kind of shitty.
Yeah, they were the worst.
But yeah, no, just a fun connection. Like, not like Raff has struck me as very different to Andy and Eva. Like, he's much more magically equipped than they were. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's because they were kind of tangential to the network.
Yeah, they were... You know, they were in service in JSB, so
yeah,
Yeah, it's interesting.
I know, just a fun little connection. Again, much like DD, the sort of thing that like would not have jumped out to a pale reader, but when they get to fact, they're going to be like, oh, neat.
The kind of thing that we'll be excited to hear about more in Pale in Comparison.
Yes, yeah. Which, if you're not listening to it, it's so much fun. It's so good.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So one other thing that we should bring up, and I guess I'm surprised we haven't brought this up before, but I guess it's just because we haven't done a back-to-pact in a while. But, you know, the whole thing with Jeremy is very interesting, I think, especially given what we know of him in Pact.
So Ruben's been hyping this up. So this whole thing is just because he's got the same first name as Jeremy Meath?
Elliot, he's the same character, undeniably. We've
absolutely made this joke before.
Oh, have we? Oh, fuck.
To be fair, maybe I just made it in my live reads. Maybe we haven't made it in an episode. Whoops.
Well, that was the joke, yeah, that they've got the same name and therefore are the same character.
I regret telling you about that time-traveling Tyrion fetus theory in Game of Thrones.
Makes me so happy. Now people think there might be time-traveling fetus theories.
I know, but you've taken it far too close to heart. I don't like it.
It's an inspiration to fan theorists everywhere, I think.
That's true. There is also a Jezza in this story, and he is... Okay, which Jeremy? If you had to pick a Jeremy, there's the game.
To pick for what situation?
Just life.
You know, I'm going to pick Meath. I'm going to pick Meath. I'm a big fan of the whole Dionysus priest kind of vibe. So despite how depressing Meath's life was, you couldn't help but love him.
Yeah, and they're both pretty good at, like, being in difficult relationships.
Yeah, sure, I guess.
Jeremy and Verona are totally not in a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm kind of picturing Jeremy, pale Jeremy, young Jeremy, we'll call him.
His surname is Clifford.
That was confirmed by Wildbo. Or was Wildbo just misdirecting us for the kind of post-credit scene of Pale that we get later where Jeremy meets a young... No, wouldn't be young, sorry, because we're in the future. It would be an old, I don't know, Duncan Behame or whatever, who's like, Jeremy, I must send you back in time. And so young Jeremy gets sent back, let's say, 40 years, grows up, becomes old Jeremy from Pact, and it's one timeline, and that's how it's all going to happen.
Yeah, no, he's going to go to... Well, not Jacob's Bell, but wherever. And he's going to meet Sandra.
Yeah.
And he's going to be like, I'm going to marry that woman.
Yeah, I'm going to marry that woman 30 years ago.
Yeah, even though she's 30 years older than me.
Yeah.
And so then Alistair will be there because Rose and Sandra were talking about something. Yep, and Alistair will hook him up.
Yep. Yeah, confirmed, I think.
Cool. Well, as per usual, we have no actual ending for this episode. And I guess we're just going to have to leave it on that.
I guess.